loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, tomorrow is Election Day as tens of millions of people prepare to go to the polls to vote in a variety of federal, state, and local elections. But if there's a change of party control in either the House or the Senate, will the politics of this country really shift? Next, in an interview yesterday, Donald Trump shrugged off U.S. responsibility for the horrific airstrike on a school bus in Yemen that killed 51, including 40 children, saying, quote, "That was basically people that didn't know how to use the weapon." But what is the real role of the United States in this deadly war? Then, if the Democrats win tomorrow, who will the Republicans blame? And if the Republicans win, who will the Democrats blame? From Russian interference to Chinese interference to much maligned but extremely rare voter fraud, the two major U.S. political parties have a number of scapegoats at the ready to avoid blame. And then, just days before the midterm election, Donald Trump amped up his anti-immigrant rhetoric and announced that he would send up to 15,000 U.S. soldiers to the U.S.-Mexico border. As rank-and-file soldiers are yet again used as political pawns, U.S. military veterans are calling on their fellow service members to refuse the order to deploy. And finally, today we continue our segment, Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the midterm elections. Yes, they are almost over. Tomorrow is Election Day as tens of millions of people prepare to go to the polls to vote in a variety of federal, state, and local elections. But if there's a change of party control in either the House or the Senate, will the politics of this country actually shift? We're joined from New York City by Dave Lindorf. Dave is an investigative reporter, a columnist for Counterpunch, and a contributor to Businessweek, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. And we're joined by Ted Rawl. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist, my favorite cartoonist. You can check out his work at Rawl.com. That's R-A-L-L.com. Dave and Ted, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, we want to get into whether this election, which has got so much political engagement. I mean, people who are Democrats, people who are Republicans, people who are independents, the media, both parties. This is not a small thing. This is a big deal. I want to get into the question of, does it really matter, though, and why it matters and how it might not matter as much as people might think it might matter. But first, as we always do in a ridiculous fashion, ask people to make a prediction. Ted Rawl, Casey Stengel, the New York Yankees manager, always said, I never make predictions, especially about the future. But Ted Rawl, anyway, what's your thought? What's your prediction?
What I don't like is the uncertainty principle. I called 2016 for Trump in February of that year, and I went to sleep at 8:45 on election night, and I was very smug about that. But now my smugness comes to an end because I'm going to predict the Democrats take the House by 3, but honestly, it's plus or minus 10 seats.
That's a very safe prediction.
Thank you.
And Dave Lindorf, real quick to you, same thing. And again, this actually has no meaning, so I don't even know why I'm asking you to make predictions, but go ahead, since everyone does it.
Yeah. I wasn't quite as savvy a predictor as Ted about Trump in the presidential election 2016, but I thought he had a shot. I'll say that.
Okay, that was then. What about tomorrow?
Having said that, I think that also the House is pretty much sewn up for the Democrats, barring what the New York Times is saying would be a complete reversal of what the polls are saying,
which is exactly what happened in 2016.
Well, no, but not really. I mean, that was a unique situation because it was several states by a very small number. For the whole Congress prediction to be wrong would be, not two or three states. It would be a pretty significant difference.
Dave Lindorf, because we have limited time, so you're predicting the House will go to the Democrats, the Republicans will retain the Senate?
Not only that, I think they have a good shot at actually picking up seats, just because of the way this particular group of senators up for election are. It's mostly Republicans are just not facing a lot of contested seats.
Ted Rall, there's kind of different parts of this vote when you look at the demographics. I'm not talking about race or ethnicity so much, but you have urban voters, urban and suburban voters, say suburbs and exurbs, and then you have rural voters. Anyway, the toss-up seems to be the issue of the suburbs. Will they go Democratic because they're repulsed by some of Donald Trump's extreme racism, xenophobia, et cetera, et cetera? Talk about that. And also, if the Democrats win the House, Ted Rall, by whatever, 3 votes or 5 votes, will it matter? Will it impact on the lives of human beings in the United States?
Well, it might matter eventually, but it's so here's the thing. Here we really have to look at the spread here, right? Because let's just say that the Democrats take the House, but by a very small margin, like we say, 3, 4, 5 seats. Well, if a lot of those seats are in purple districts, then those are going to be sort of Democrats in name only, sort of a la Joe Manchin in West Virginia, who voted for Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation. That kind, I know he's in the Senate, but anyway, they're going to be those kinds of personalities. And you're going to be looking at to see something really happen, you're going to want to see a big wave, like 15, 20, 25 seats, so that even by a comfortable margin, you have enough of an anti-Trump contingent that there really could be a wave, a blue wave of subpoenas and investigations. And now that's might change things. Of course, we all know that as political junkies, that investigations and hearings often don't amount to much. The Mueller investigation doesn't seem like it's going to amount to a hell of a lot at this stage. So it might just be more of the same. Not to mention, I just can't get past the calendar. The primaries really kind of begin in earnest in September. The new Congress takes office in January, so that gives the Democrats all of about 7 months, including about 2 months of vacation, to try to get this president up against the ropes on some kind of charge, some kind of gotcha moment before they have to pivot to the election, because they don't want to be doing these hearings during the primaries when they want the focus to be on their own primary campaign. So I just don't think much is going to happen.
Yeah, I hear you. Dave Lindorf, that makes a lot of sense to me, what Ted Rall is saying. I mean, if it's basically conservative Democrats, and there's a lot of them, you know, former SEALs and special forces and military people who are competing against moderate Republicans in states that were kind of maybe historically Republican, still pretty Republican, but people who are repulsed by Donald Trump, the person, I don't see any like significant change happening as a consequence. And also, Dave, real quick, because I know you wrote an article entitled Many Rural Citizens Vote Against Their Own Medicaid in State and Federal Elections. Again, that's rural voters who are historically going to be voting either Republican or are considered the Trump base. Go ahead.
I'll go to your first question. I agree with you guys. It's a boring show because we all agree that...
It's not boring. Never say that about this show.
We're not arguing. I don't know what's wrong with you guys. We're not arguing. The idea that I had been thinking this myself, that you know, this is an election, one of those elections that are why the Democrats are such a drag as a party, because they end up winning in these marginal races or you know, sort of now we call them purple states or purple districts in the case of congressional districts, where they have to run as Republicans in order to win the race. And so what that does is it pulls the whole party to the right. And so it diminishes the clout of the left-leaning candidates who come in. And there are going to be some, you know, there is a parallel shift that we've seen some, you know, more real leftists running and winning primaries and being in seats, you know, like I'm thinking of Osorio Cortez and the woman in Boston who was the mayor. Winning a congressional seat. These are people who are pretty far to the left, and even Gillum is fairly to the left as governor in Florida and probably going to win. So you get these progressives, like real progressives, who are winning because of the sort of Bernie Sanders effect and, you know, going out and running and winning primaries and then winning races. But their clout is going to be neutralized by all of these conservative Democrats who are going to probably be the reason that the House goes Democratic.
Ted Rall, we have 2 minutes left. The Democrats controlled the House of Representatives and the Senate by large margins in 2009-2010. Barack Obama was a very popular president at that time. They could have done whatever they wanted to do. They did whatever they wanted to do. The reason we don't have Medicare right now, the reason we don't have Medicare for All, a single-payer plan, is because the Democrats, when they could have, didn't do it. Now they're going around demanding that people pay attention to health care and how the trashing of the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid expansion, which is, of course, very bad, what Trump and the Republicans are doing. But nonetheless, when they had all that they could want from an electoral point of view, from a governing point of view, they didn't do much with it.
No, they didn't. And internalization of what the Obama administration refused to do, helping out the distressed homeowners during the housing after the housing crisis, more aid for the unemployed, putting in a public option as Obama had promised during the 08 campaign, all that stuff. That kind of that more than anything else defines kind of the split in the Democratic Party between the Hillary Clinton wing and the Bernie Sanders progressives. People who have internalized that fact tend to lean more toward Bernie, and vice versa. So I think it seems like it's a part of history that has been willfully forgotten by half the party, or these days actually less than half the party, because progressives really do amount to a majority of Democratic voters. But I think that it's, you know, the consequences of this split are going to be much bigger in the 2020 presidential election than they are now.
That was Ted Rall. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at rall.com. That's RALL.com. We were also joined from New York by Dave Lindorf, an investigative reporter, a columnist for Counterpunch, and a contributor to Business Week, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. In an interview yesterday, Donald Trump shrugged off U.S. responsibility for the horrific airstrike on a school bus in Yemen that killed 51, including 40 children, saying, quote, "That was basically people that didn't know how to use the weapon," close quote. But what is the real role of the United States in this deadly war? We're joined from New York by Ann Wright. Ann is a retired U.S. Army colonel and former U.S. State Department official in Afghanistan and elsewhere. She resigned in protest of the 2003 invasion of Iraq and is now an anti-war activist. Ann Wright, welcome back.
Thank you, Brian.
Any reactions to your president's comments about Yemen?
Oh, my God. Oh, yes, lots of reactions. I mean, President Trump continues to give credence to the comments of the Saudi government of, you know, their need to kill people in Yemen. It's just horrific what's going on. And certainly the targeting aspect of what the Saudis are doing is part of the U.S. contribution to the horrific war on Yemen that has killed so many people, and including that busload of kids coming from school. Not only does the U.S. help with the targeting of drones and of Saudi bombers, but it also refuels the Saudi aircraft as they're coming across to wreak havoc in Yemen. And this whole issue of they just didn't know how to use the technology. Well, I mean, there have been so many cases of specific targeting of people that are the civilians of the wedding parties, of the funeral parties, of the school buses. They know exactly what they're doing, and Donald Trump is just providing excuses for war crimes that they're committing.
Yeah, Ann Wright is our guest. We're talking about Donald Trump's comments about the bombing attack that killed 51, including 40 kids, young kids, on a school bus in Yemen. Again, I want to read a little bit more to you from Donald Trump's comments. This was basically people that didn't know how to use the weapons, which is horrible. I'll be talking about a lot of things with the Saudis, but certainly I wouldn't be having people that don't know how to use the weapons shooting at buses with children. I mean, I would say it's a laughable comment, except it's too macabre, too cavalier. And at the same time, what you're suggesting, Ann Wright, is that far from being a mistake, the targeting of civilians is the actual military strategy. We've seen this in other wars. It wouldn't it be the first time in history. I traveled a great deal with Ramsey Clark, the former U.S. Attorney General, who went to Iraq during the first Gulf War and brought back the first uncensored video footage. Didn't go through an Iraq censor, didn't go through a Pentagon censor. And it showed, by the way, none of the media here would, play it. It showed that the U.S. was bombing once, twice, three times civilian centers. And there were comments made by some U.S. Air Force high command personnel that part of the military attacks was to effectuate greater damage caused earlier by the economic sanctions. In other words, kind of a 1-2 punch. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, indeed. What you all brought back from the first Gulf War and then the history of U.S. involvement in these wars shows that the U.S. does target civilians. And we are passing on that idea to the Saudis. I mean, if you look at all of the civilian targets that there have been in Yemen. In fact, I've just come back from a conference in Pakistan, and one of the presenters there is a fellow from Sweden who's written a remarkable book about Yemen called Destroying Yemen. And in his presentation, he had slides on his PowerPoint of all of the cultural places, museums, archaeological places that have been targeted and blown up. I mean, not only are they going after the economic centers of Yemen, of trying to get control of the oil fields and other areas, but they are purposely, systematically trying to destroy the culture of Yemen, to leave that place in total ruins. So what President Trump says about, well, they just don't know how to target and all, they know very well how to target, and they're doing, unfortunately, a real job on Yemen, not only on the people of Yemen, but on their culture.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're talking right now with Ann Wright. Ann Wright is a United States Army colonel, retired, and former U.S. State Department official. She resigned, one of the few who resigned in principle and out of principle, protesting the 2003 invasion of Iraq. We're talking about Yemen. Ann Wright, I want to get your opinion about the comments of James Mattis last week, echoed by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, that there needed to be a ceasefire in Yemen, that the war needed to be brought to an end. This was after the big brouhaha regarding the killing, the slaughtering of Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi embassy or Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Have American policymakers changed their mind on Yemen?
Well, at long last, it seems like at least they're verbally saying that they're changing their mind. Now, whether or not the policies to stop U.S. Support for the Saudis in this will happen, we'll just have to wait to see. But for God's sakes, I mean, this has been going on for 4 years now, and the same types of things that have happened in Afghanistan, the targeting of civilians, large groups of people, civilians being killed, archaeological treasures being blown up and all of this. And then the damage to the infrastructure of Yemen, where sewage, water, and things like this are the systems are destroyed, and now cholera and the largest cholera outbreak in the history of the world has happened in Yemen, and the starvation, not just the potential starvation of millions of Yemenis, it is the starvation. It's going on right now, and as we saw on the front page of the New York Times just this last week, of the horrific skeletons, I mean, living skeletons is essentially what this is before they died. A young girl that was on the front page of the New York Times that was nothing but just skin and bone that you could see through there, she died this week because she'd been starved to death. And when you think about the tens of thousands, millions of Yemenis who have not had a good meal in years, and this is because of the blockade that the international community, led by the United States and Saudi Arabia, have put on the ports of Yemen, Hodeidah, Aden, all of these ports that international aid groups normally helped with food. And, you know, Yemen produced a lot of food itself. It wasn't like it was totally dependent on the international community for foodstuffs, but with war going on everywhere, they cannot grow the food because the fields have been bombed and mined, and it's just horrific. So this thing of where finally the U.S. says it needs to, the war needs to end. Well, yes, for God's sakes, it does. But for the plight of millions of Yemenis, it's coming a little bit too late.
Why is this war happening? Is this Mohammed bin Salman's war? Is it the Saudi royal family's war? What's the goal of the war?
Well, certainly there's always been tension in the northern provinces of Yemen with the Saudis. The Houthis who are up in that northern area, there's always been cross-border operations, so to speak. I think the Saudis wanted once and for all just to eliminate any sort of dissent that's coming out of Yemen. They've given refuge to the horrific dictator, Saleh, who was thrown out 5 years ago. And in fact, I was with a delegation led by Code Pink Women for Peace about 4.5 years ago at the time when there was a transitional national congress going on among all parties in Yemen after Saleh was thrown out. And the hope, I mean, it was really an exciting time to be there because the hope of finally getting rid of a dictatorship and having a governmental structure that everyone could agree on. And then this war started with the Houthis and other groups. It's not just the Houthis. I mean, there are a lot of other groups in Yemen that were violently opposed to the dictatorship of Saleh. So while the international community focuses on the Houthis and the alleged support out of Iran, I mean, certainly 5 years ago, they weren't getting any support. They may be now because people are jumping in on all sides. Governments are jumping in on all sides. And it's become just a battleground, as Afghanistan was and is, of a variety of groups for a variety of interests. Same thing in Syria, and it's been the same thing in Iraq. It's a moneymaker for the warmongers and for the private militias and militias that are on hire from around the region. I just want to make one other comment. 2 weeks ago, I was in Istanbul at a conference on Palestine, and it was in the time when Jamal Khashoggi's body had not been found, and in fact, the Saudis had not yet decided to acknowledge that he'd been murdered in their own consulate by their own agents. And I went to the consulate about midnight, the last night of the conference, because I wanted to stand as a witness, you know, to what was happening. And two Egyptian journalists who were exiled from the al-Sisi government in Egypt and are exiled in Turkey, which is ironic because Turkey has more journalists in jail than any other country right now. Over 170 Turkish journalists are in jail, yet it is the place where exiles from other authoritarian dictatorships have been able to find a place. Anyway, we went there and stood there, and I mean, it was the most eerie thing you've ever felt, you know, just shivers up your spine about the diplomatic mission where a murder had taken place. And yet, it's one person, and yet when you see the murders and executions of the wholesale genocide that Saudi Arabia is doing on the people of Yemen, it doesn't pale, but it is. It puts in one person versus the millions that are being affected in Yemen. And I think that is the thing we really need to keep in mind as we are bombarded with all of the stuff about Jamal Khashoggi's death. But let's not forget those people in Yemen.
Yeah, I hear you. Killing of a million is a statistic, but they're not statistics. They're human beings. Anyway, we're out of time. We were joined from New York City by Ann Wright. Ann is a retired United States Army colonel and former U.S. State Department official, one of the few brave souls who actually resigned out of principle against in protest of the Bush-Cheney invasion of Iraq in 2003. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Tomorrow, of course, are the midterm elections. If the Democrats win tomorrow, who will the Republicans blame? And if the Republicans win, who will the Democrats blame? From Russian interference to Chinese interference to much maligned but extremely rare, quote, voter fraud and less maligned but very frequent voter suppression, the two major U.S. political parties have a number of scapegoats at the ready to avoid blame. We're joined from Pennsylvania by Jim Kavanaugh, editor of thepolemicist.net, whose latest piece is Taxpayers' Money Threatens Medicare for All and Every Other Social Program. Jim Kavanaugh, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So anyway, Jim, talk about this. Of course, there will be, as there always is, the blame game after the election, after Hillary Clinton and the Democrats couldn't explain their inexplicable loss to the most unpopular political figure in American history running for president. That would be Donald J. Trump. They blamed the Russians. At first, they blamed James Comey. They blamed, you know, there was lots of blaming. But ultimately, they fixated on the Russians. Now, Donald Trump is saying if the midterms go the wrong way for the Republicans, especially given the fact that China has imposed tariffs, say, on some agricultural products, it will be China's fault. Anyway, what's your take?
Yeah, well, we have a system which, unfortunately, is not transparent, is so untransparent that there's a lot of room for people to do this blame game. And both parties, neither party wants to acknowledge the political victories of the other party or the political faults of their own. And the fact that they lose support, you're in this crazy electoral jigsaw with people get annoyed at the party in power, so they swing back to the other party because neither party actually does anything that helps people much. So you have a lot of opportunity for blame, and you have an electoral system that is incredibly complicated and untransparent. You talked about the voter suppression. We've seen already in this election voting machines, the electronic voting machines switching votes, and you have the problem of people not being able to register, and it's a crazy patchwork of laws and regulations governing elections. So at the end of the day, people can say, you know, yesterday the Republicans were blaming the Democrats for hacking an election because the Democrats said there were problems with the election, and the Republicans said they could only know that by hacking it. So, you know, I don't know what to say. I'm very skeptical of the electoral system in general in the country. And you have this situation where they want to get people excited about voting, but they keep this system so complicated and so opaque that at the end of the day, they'll say, oh, you know, so-and-so was the Russians or the Chinese. I mean, that's just incredibly ridiculous. Or it was, you know, the fact that the George Soros put $1 billion or the New York Times put $1 billion and all of those things have an effect, but nobody knows. Actually, you can't have a clear idea of how I think the problem in the country is. You can't have a clear idea of how valid the electoral process is. So you're going to have these things coming up all the time.
Glenn Greenwald, Jim Kavanaugh tweeted, Washington media and political elites love simultaneously to A, mock others for recklessly spreading conspiracy theories, and B, recklessly spread conspiracy theories Whether such conspiracy drivel is scorned or admired is purely a function of who it helps. DC is full of this stuff. And then Greenwald is pointing us to another tweet by David Kleon, and he tweets, "This is an overgenerous assessment of who Lindsey Graham, was before, but never mind that. I just admire how close this comes to outright speculating that Graham is being blackmailed." And that is in response to the tweet from Norman Ornstein. Norman Ornstein tweeted, "New York Times with devastating front page story on how Lindsey Graham became Trump's toady, including deep sixing his own promised subcommittee investigation into Russia. There is something more to his complete reversal and abdication of responsibility to America than the story suggests." Meaning, Jim Kavanaugh, that this now is Lindsey Graham, who's obviously climbing the popularity escalator after his big attack on Dr. Christine Blasey Ford at the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, and who may be the next attorney general. He's actually being blackmailed by the Russians. Bottom line, Russians again.
Yeah, it really is unbelievable. I mean, Norman Ornstein, of course, who's a old neoconservative, and you know, he and Max Boot, now the old neoconservatives, have turned into the moderate voices of reason, you know, against Trumpism, and you know, they've become favorites of the centrists.
Yeah, he was with the American Enterprise Institute. We used to think during the Reagan era you can't get more right than the American Yes. Enterprise Institute, except now Norman Ornstein is just a neocon centrist, part of the anti-Trump resistance, I guess.
Exactly. So he's now saying that Lindsey Graham has betrayed his moderate centrism and become a true Trumper. Of course, Lindsey Graham has become very popular among Trump Republicans after his performance, as you say, at the Kavanaugh hearings. But, you know, this is Lindsey Graham is a right-wing reactionary and has been for a long time. And he was willing to vote along. You know, he promoted himself as a protege of John McCain. So he was one of these, according to the Democrats and the centrists, you know, moderate Republicans. And he did say nasty things about Trump. But this is just political opportunism. He's taking advantage of the fact that he's very popular now among Trump Republicans because of what he did with Kavanaugh hearings. And he's going with that, and he'll go with what he can go with. And it's going to probably help him electorally. But there's nothing, you know, he hasn't had a change of heart in any way, any more than Norman Ornstein has or Max Boot has. They're still right-wing, you know, neoconservative warmongers. And they look for scapegoats, and Russia is one of the favorites. And they're castigating Graham for not being hard enough with his committee on the Russiagate investigation, and maybe he's a suggestion that maybe he's now taking a bribe from Russia in order to be nicer to Donald Trump is like, wow, you know, where does this come from? You know, this is the level of political discourse we have in the country, and that's why it's hard to get excited about the politics of the electoral politics, because the debate is over those things, and it really goes, it gets a little annoying to hear.
And now, Jim Kavanaugh, we have Trump blaming China for interfering in the election. Again, even though we've covered some of this territory, I don't mind covering it once again. It's the United States government, as a government, that perfected the tactic of intervening in other countries' elections all over the world, starting in the late 1940s, mid-1940s, with the effort to prevent the Italian Communist Party from not necessarily taking power, but even coming into the government when the Communist Party, were the largest party, having been the leaders of the armed resistance against the fascist Mussolini, to Chile and the overthrow of Allende, Guatemala, Iran, you name it. The U.S. has perfected it. And again, in our mainstream media, Jim Kavanaugh, this is sometimes like acknowledged as a little asterisk, a little footnote, but not a big deal.
Yeah, and the liberal centrists like to treat it as if every time, you know, it's something that's part of the past that's never going to happen again. And then it happens again. They say, oh, my gosh, that must have been a rogue thing. Or, you know, let's not pay any attention to it. It's not really seriously part of America, of what America is, when in fact it is exactly what America is and has been in terms of being an anti-democratic force in the world and not wanting to allow the results of democratic elections. I mean, Dominican Republic, as you say, Chile, all of these elections, if they don't elect the right people, we're going to overthrow them. And in this country, you have elections that are incredibly difficult to accept. You have twice presidential elections with where the majority voted, the person who won the majority of the vote didn't get elected. And you had the incredible difficulty of reconciling exit polling with the actual results in the Democratic primaries in 2016 and in the machine and in throughout the country. So we have no position in the world to be claiming we are the standard of electoral democracy. And it's kind of crazy to see this going. China, where do you get this thing that China is now, I guess this is Trump's card to put on the table in response to the Democrats Russia thing, but it's, you know, it's kind of out of the blue. You're going to blame somebody for losing.
Yeah.
Anybody but your own political fault, your own political weakness, your own inability to actually put a political program on the table that's going to benefit the majority of people in the United States of America. And neither the Republicans nor the Democrats can do that. So they end up this either fear-mongering and racism, or they end up with this kind of Trump's in the pocket of Russiagate or of Russia. Or
And there are some countries they never blame. Like Israel is never blamed, even though Israel was clearly interfering in the U.S. electoral process and with U.S. politicians. Same with Saudi Arabia. These were perhaps the two biggest. That's just, again, no big deal. Actually, not a deal at all, not even mentioned.
Yeah, in fact, one of the things that you see with this, with the incredible complexity and opaqueness of the American electoral process, is both parties want that this way. They don't want something which is transparent and easy to access, and people can see what's going on. They like the system which depends on money, depends on donors, is built around consultants and media buys and things like that. And it's a very complicated process that people don't control. And they like that.
We're going to leave it right there. We were joined from Pennsylvania by Jim Kavanaugh. Jim is the editor of thepolemicist.net. His latest piece is Taxpayers' Money Threatens Medicare for All and Every Other Social Program. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Just days before the midterm election, Donald Trump amped up his anti-immigrant rhetoric and announced that he would send up to 15,000 active duty U.S. soldiers and Marines to the U.S.-Mexico border. As rank-and-file soldiers are yet again used as political pawns, U.S. military veterans are calling on their fellow service members to refuse the order to deploy. We're joined from Los Angeles by Michael Preisner. He was a U.S. veteran who served 4 years in the Army, one of them in Iraq. He is also a documentary filmmaker and the co-host of the anti-war podcast Eyes Left. Mike Preisner, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Hey, thanks for having me again, Brian.
A question. I mean, I know you through your work in the anti-war movement. You helped organize the Veterans and Active Duty Service Members Organization March Forward that tried to attend to the needs, unmet needs of many, many thousands, maybe tens of thousands or even more U.S. soldiers and Marines, sailors and veterans who are suffering in a very profoundly negative way, the personal impact of having been deployed to Iraq and to Afghanistan. I also know you as someone who has opposed the U.S. war in Iraq, a war that you participated in during the first part of the invasion. Here we have Donald Trump sending 15,000 Marines and soldiers to the U.S.-Mexico border to guard against the caravan, you know, thousands, several thousands of mothers and their kids and some dads, certainly not an armed contingent. How are soldiers taking it?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that 15,000, because that's actually larger than the invasion force of the U.S. military that was sent to Afghanistan in the invasion of Afghanistan. And also kind of strange considering that the caravan is, you know, we know where it's going, and it's going to a port of entry, and it has lots of cameras with it. So the idea that they're going to try to sneak across the border in one of these three states where the military is deploying, Arizona, Texas, and California, it shows that there's something much deeper going on. But, you know, I've been in touch with several people in the military, and I mean, this is actually, you know, causing a real moral crisis of conscience with a lot of active duty soldiers, because they're seeing, you know, what they're, you know, they're being used as pawns, but they're also being used to do very real border operations.
I know rank and file soldiers and Marines and sailors have one vantage point. I'm looking, though, even at people who are in the high command. David Lappin, a Defense Department former spokesperson and a retired Marine colonel, he also stated his opposition. He said, quote, "The border security mission is a law enforcement one. And active duty military forces are prohibited by law from conducting domestic law enforcement activities. The troops being dispatched to the border are in a support role only." Now, that's interesting, because that would suggest that the deployment is not legal, that it's a violation of U.S. law. If you and others who are trying to get the word out are telling soldiers, active duty soldiers or active duty Marines, don't deploy, perhaps there's actually a legal basis for not deploying.
There is. I mean, it's actually against the law. The law that it's invoking is that the military cannot be used for domestic policing operations, except in the case of some kind of national emergency where they're kind of deputized to serve kind of emergency policing functions. And this includes a range of things from, you know, it's illegal to detain people and seize their property, to conduct support surveillance of civilians that's not authorized, and a variety of things like that. And so there are things that, you know, soldiers there on the ground can find themselves being ordered to do that are actually illegal. But, you know, that story is also being used as a way to kind of say that the military is against this, and the Department of Homeland Security is kind of backing off it. But that's just for certain functions, right? And so it's kind of presenting this image that, well, since they're not going to be serving law enforcement functions, they're only serving this kind of support role. And it's feeding into this story. And, you know, I've seen even Obama called it a political stunt. Democrats are saying, you know, soldiers are just being used as props. But, and, you know, they're also certainly asserting that, oh, the soldiers aren't going to be armed, and so it's all for show because most of the soldiers aren't going to have rifles. But despite that, you know, they did deny doing these kind of policing operations, but they still approved all of the other types of operations that are serving as support role. And what is that? If you look at the photos, they're putting up barbed wire fences. They're setting up surveillance operations. If you look at the units that are deploying, they're sending intelligence units, observation units. They're sending an entire military police brigade from Fort Hood. You can see from the photos that they're gearing up for patrols like they would do in Afghanistan. And they're spreading across these three border states. And so we can't minimize what's happening. It's not just for show. They're going to be doing real border operations. And their job is going to be whether or not they're doing these textbook policing operations, they're going to be aiding the border patrol and in a lot of ways aiding these right-wing militias that are doing this stuff on the border also. But their whole mission is going to be giving the border patrol support to hunt down and capture migrant families and then put them in cages. And beyond that, their mission is to be this beefed up security on the border in areas where it's safest to cross, so as to funnel migrants through the most dangerous, risky pathways where hundreds die every single year in the desert.
Mike Prisner is our guest. We're talking about the U.S. military deployment, 15,000 troops sent by Donald Trump to the U.S.-Mexican border. Mike Prisner, you're the co-host of the podcast Eyes Left. Your other co-host is Spencer Rapone. Spencer Rapone is an 8-year Army vet who served in Afghanistan. He and Rory Fanning just published an open letter that called, basically, I believe, on the troops not to do it, not to be deployed. Talk about that initiative.
Yeah, you can find it on thenation.com and many other websites. Spencer Rapone and Rory Fanning are both former Army Rangers, you know, elite special operations unit. Both are Afghanistan vets, and both became war resistors and disobeyed orders and then were disciplined and discharged in different ways for it. So they're not calling on people to do anything that they haven't done before. But yeah, they're calling on people that if you receive your orders to the border, that you can just say no and you can walk away. And there's legal ways you can do it. And there's other ways you can do it where, you know, you may get a slap on the wrist or something like that. But they're also saying that even if you're not deploying, you have a special role to play too. And I think the a main point of their call is saying that this is just it's going to get worse from here, right? And if Trump is able to carry out this massive border deployment, which a lot of soldiers are conflicted about, and especially ones that, I've been talking to, have been longtime loyal soldiers for 15 years or more. If nobody takes a stand within the military against this, then it just sets a precedent, and then it can get much worse. And so they're saying not just to the humanity of refusing to take part in these immoral border operations, but it's crucial for us as soldiers at this moment to really make known our views, because it can very easily spiral into something bigger, and this just being kind of the first step in that.
Mike Prisner, this appears to all who are watching to be an act of racism on the part of the Trump administration to generate political support from his base who would respond to that kind of racism. Racism is a big issue now for soldiers and for the troops in the U.S. military. What's the impact?
Well, the impact is that a recent poll just showed that the majority of soldiers believe, in fact, three-fourths of soldiers see a growing polarization within the ranks. And of course, that's a polarization over Trump, because Trump's whole administration and his persona is based on racism. And so if you're supporting Trump, then you're signing on to this kind of white supremacist resurgence, both from racist policies in the government and from white supremacist vigilante street actions and gangs and things like that. And so you can't see yourself as separate from this larger phenomenon of growing and resurgent white supremacist and proto-fascist movement in the United States. I think many are recognizing that and feeling conflicted, and that's why they, of course, should exercise all of their rights to get out of it, not just by being CO, but you can just walk away. I mean, there's not much the military can do to you if you just walk away.
And 15 seconds left, Mike. A lot of opposition then to the racism from within the military, from the rank and file?
It is, and it's definitely growing.
All right. We're going to leave it right there. We were joined from Los Angeles by Michael Prisner. Mike is a U.S. veteran. He served 4 years in the U.S. Army. He was in the Iraq invasion. He became a fierce opponent of the U.S. war in Iraq and Afghanistan. He is also a documentary filmmaker and a co-host of the anti-war podcast Eyes Left. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Today we continue our segment every Monday, Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill Ayers helps us look at the state of education across the country, what's happening in our schools, our colleges, our universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us. We're joined from Chicago by Bill Ayers. He's an activist and an award-winning educator, the author of several books, many books, including Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto. Bill Ayers, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Good to hear your voice, Brian.
Thank you. I mean, here we are on the eve of a much-anticipated election tomorrow. Now, you know, Bill, as you know, there's been a lot of talk over the decades and over the ages about how the masses of people are filled with apathy and lassitude and disinterest. And we could say with certainty that's actually not the case at all right now. There's a lot of political engagement. And it raises the question, how do students in public schools or other schools learn about elections, learn about civics? How are civics taught in the United States? So let's get your two cents on that. And again, your own feeling, here we are on the eve of this midterm election.
Well, you know, I am, I think, riveted to the election, as I think many, many people are. I don't actually buy the idea that apathy is the natural condition. I think apathy is manufactured by those in power. And apathy is one more example of voter suppression. When you think about voter suppression, we always go to questions like, how people are not allowed to vote early, or people are stricken from the voting rolls, or felony disenfranchisement. But voter suppression goes back to the beginning of this country. Voter suppression was the name of the game. Now, I mean, why do we have a electoral college? Why do we have a Senate? These are undemocratic institutions, but they're based on the idea that we don't want the masses engaged, and people get the message, and everything from kind of insane advertising and the kind of cage fighting of our electoral politics drive people away from the polls. But I think this is an important election. I think every election is important. The thing I always try to remind my friends on the left of is that voting is a tactic, not a strategy and not a principle. You should vote. People died for the right to vote. People struggled for the right to vote. They went to jail for the right to vote. And all over the world, people are struggling for the right to vote. So to act as if it's just something that we should sneeze at is wrong. On the other hand, it takes 5 minutes. You're not voting on principle. You're not voting for the perfect person who's going to save us. No politician is going to save us. We can only save ourselves. However, does it make a difference? Yes, it does. And when my friends on the left say, well, do you really want to vote for the lesser of two evils? My response is, it is lesser. And let's go for lesser. Absolutely. Evil is bad. Let's go for lesser. So, yeah, I think the elections are important. And then what you do the next day is also important.
Bill Ayers is our guest. We're talking, as we do every Monday, about education in America. This segment is called Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, a different concept, not unique, but a different concept, certainly from the mainstream orientation towards education, Bill Ayers. I'm looking at the 2018 Brown Center report on American education. It's published, or at least it's being promoted at the Brookings Institute website. I want to read a couple words to you from their report. This report comes out annually, and it gauges how education is going in the public schools. But this time, it's also focused on politics and on what it means to teach civics to kids in school. Here's from the report. A growing sentiment holds that many of the country's greatest challenges today relate to the state of its politics, with implications for the cohesion of American society and the functioning of its democracy. However, even as politics increasingly penetrate American classrooms, U.S. education policy, as implemented in state accountability systems, for example, continues to emphasize students' performance in mathematics and reading as the dominant focus of the K-12 schooling, to the extent that this emphasis has crowded out a focus on students' civic development, we should ask whether today's schools are, in fact, responsive to the needs of our time. Anyway, Bill Ayers, your reaction.
Well, I think that's true, except I don't think that I think it's a pretty vague statement. Yes, there's too much focus on math and reading. Yes, we should focus on history and culture and politics, absolutely, in our schools. However, when somebody writes a paragraph like the one you just read, part of what they mean is that we should be teaching obedience and conformity to the state of things the way they are. I'm all for teaching civics. If by that they mean, and this is what I would mean by it, if by that we mean civic engagement and not simply a drive for canned goods to give to the poor, but actually engaging in the issues of our day in our communities and taking seriously questions like, are we living in a society that's fair? Is it just? Is the justice system delivering justice, or is it unjust? I mean, is it criminal? And I think that exploring those things is what kids really want. And so I can give you one hilarious example. I was visiting a former student of mine, and he was delivering a lesson on Brown versus Board of Education. And the theme of the lesson was the upward trajectory of progress around race and inclusion in our society. The problem was he was teaching the lesson in a segregated school on the south side of Chicago. One of the kids, who I thought was kind of sleeping in the back, suddenly piped up and said, "No, Mr. Smith, are we breaking the law here?" And everybody cracked up. But his point was very, very accurate, which is Brown versus Board of Education claims that separate but equal is illegal. It is not allowed. And what the kid was pointing out was the hypocrisy of teaching that kind of civics lesson or that kind of history lesson in a place where your own eyes can tell you that it's not true. And so I think that what Mr. Smith did was actually say, let's explore that. Let's go out and look at patterns of segregation in Chicago. And how did it get this way? Is it a natural phenomenon, or is it the result of politics and policy? That's civics engagement. I don't think that's what the people who wrote this report are talking about, but that, I think, is very necessary if we're going to have kids who are literate in politics and engagement with the the community at large.
Yeah, I agree with you. We have about 3 minutes left, Bill. When I'm reading the report, I just kind of scanned it quickly. It seems platitudinous, a word I've been waiting to use all day. But
oh, that's great. The word of the week.
Yeah, but let me just read again a couple sentences real quick, and then motivating this framework, this is from the report, motivating this framework is a notion that teaching students facts about U.S. government is a goal, but not the exclusive goal of civics education. The aim of civics education is broader and includes providing students with an understanding of how democratic processes work, as well as how to engage these processes. You know, when I read that, going back to it being a platitude, it seems to me that the assumption is that the American system is democratic and you just have to learn how to get in and sort of game the system or work the system in the traditional ways that politics works in America, when in fact, to really make American democracy work, you have to do something quite, quite different. Go ahead.
Well, that's exactly right. It seems to me that what the platitudinous aspect of the report is that they're saying facts is a goal, understanding democracy is a goal, but they don't problematize either of those. So you may know that in Florida a decade ago, 2008, and in Arizona, they passed legislation in the state legislature saying history shall be taught as the facts and nothing but the facts. History is not, say, quote, a construction or an interpretation. It's only the facts. Well, tell me this. What is the fact of Columbus Day? What's the fact of the Spanish invasion of the New World? I mean, whose facts are we talking about? So I think the goal of a real civics education is to problematize all the platitudes, is to make them objects of study, not objects of memorization. One of the things that characterizes real civics education is it encourages you to ask questions of the universe and encourages you to understand that you need no one's permission to ask questions of the universe. The kind of civics education this report seems to be pointing to is civics education that promotes the status quo as normative and normal and not to be questioned. That's absolutely wrong.
Bill Ayers, 1 minute left, real quick. Do teachers have the ability, meaning the flexibility, to actually do that kind of thoughtful examination of civics issues and go through the process with students, or are they limited as a consequence of the standardized testing? Do they have to teach to the test because that's what the students will be judged on? 30 seconds left.
Yeah, I mean, I think that teachers are both free and fated. I think, and it's not just now, that's always been true. We are told what to do. The way my brother, a legendary teacher in Berkeley, California, used to say it is, I work for the state. I've come to terms with the fact that I'm an agent of the state 60% of the time, but boy, that 40% I'm going to use to its fullest. And that's what teachers have to do.
That's the voice of Bill Ayers. Bill joins us every Monday in this segment called Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers. Bill is an activist and award-winning educator, the author of numerous books, including Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto.
You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.